From runasradio.com, you're listening to Run As Radio, the internet audio talk show for IT professionals with Richard Campbell. This is Brandon Wen announcing show number 365, Heartbleed with guest Troy Hunt, recorded Friday, April 18th, 2014. Run As Radio is produced each week by Quap Productions, providing professional media and podcasting services online at pwop.com. You can follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/runasradio.
Thank you, Brandon. This is Richard Campbell, and welcome to a very special Run As Radio, fit in between all of my crazy travels and Troy's. I've managed to get him on the line so that we could talk a little bit about the excitement going on in the internet today. And for those who don't know who Troy Hunt is, he's a web security guy, actually a Microsoft MVP in the subject, also does a whole bunch of Pluralsight videos, and he's the creator of the Have I Been Pwned site, where you can search for compromised accounts across a whole range of major data breaches covering hundreds of millions of records. If it talks over HTTP or sends angle brackets, Troy's going to want to break it and then teach you how to fix it. Welcome back, sir.
G'day, Richard. Thank you very much.
Although it's actually the first time I've had you on Run As. You've been on Done at Rocks a few times. I think you generally deal with developers. Although, you know, Run As is more of an IT crowd, although it covers the gamut. I've got a few enterprise guys listening who may have already dealt with this, but I think an awful lot of one and two man shops are sort of looking at Heartbleed and trying to figure out, all right, what did they do?
Yeah. And this is the thing, isn't it? A lot of us wear multiple hats, and we have to sort of, you know, whether on the IT side or the dev side, we have to deal with this thing. And for something like Heartbleed, it kind of touches everyone anyway. And I mean, it's touching consumers, right? It's in the mainstream news.
Sure.
And of course, it's going to touch sysadmins and devs and everyone in between.
And I haven't seen a mainstream news piece yet that was even vaguely close to accurate.
Oh, yeah, but aren't they sensationalist?
They are beautiful. If your business is selling soap through fear, the news has clearly got that nailed.
Yeah, and you know, this is funny. I don't think we have ever seen, I don't think objectively we've seen a vulnerability of this scale or impact of or ease of exploit before, certainly not all those things together. Nor have we seen the hysteria that is going on in the media. And I think this thing has probably got a long way to run as well.
Which seems odd because this is a very specific problem. Yes, it's OpenSSL, which is a pretty popular library, but it's only the Heartbleed, which most people had turned on. But as soon, if you're an IT admin and you run OpenSSL and you see this security issue comes down, it's seconds to just turn off Heartbleed.
Yeah, so that's true. I guess the issue was that who was actually looking at Heartbleeds and thinking it might be something we need to turn off before, and now you can always just recompile OpenSSL and turn the Heartbleed off.
Right.
I guess what's interesting is it's such a sort of innocuous little component of SSL that who would have thunk it, you know?
Well, and as the exploration has gone into how did this happen, and if, correct me if I'm wrong, because I'm just reading from the outside what they found so far. It was a patch made 2 years ago on New Year's Eve.
Yeah, how's this? It was about, I think it was 10:59 New Year's Eve.
Wow.
I believe that was the local time of the contributor. And you got to feel a little bit sorry for this guy because we've all made coding mistakes before and this may have well been purely
sure.
innocent. But you sort of look at it and go, was there just a little bit too much New Year's Eve cheer going on at the time? That would be one explanation.
Well, and the other side of this is this whole, it's the mafia, it's NSA, you know, that there's actually some diabolical behavior here.
Well, this is the thing. We have had the conspiracy bar lowered so far after the NSA revelations of 2013 that now
sure.
now the wacky stuff doesn't sound so wacky anymore, right? So we've got to lift the game.
No.
But
well, yeah, there's plenty of the Snowden papers have said that the NSA actually altered systems and weakened encryption and did all these things. This almost sounds like an NSA thing. It's perfect. It's almost untraceable. It's in the open domain. It allows you to pump machines for data without any visibility to it at all. and it was one line of code. Like, it's almost too perfect.
Yeah, that's...
like, it wouldn't be believable.
Exactly, and that's the thing. And I guess we say NSA now in a very sort of colloquial, collective way, but of course, yes, the reality of it is there's a lot of nation states out there with unfathomable sorts of resources to go through and probe popular libraries. The fact also that here we have theoretically or allegedly two different independent parties fighting it at a similar time, you got to sort of say, you know, the guys with the resources, whether it's the US or Russia or China, probably not Australia, but whether it's one of these guys, you know, have they not looked at this? Had they not found it? But the problem, of course, is that if they had, there's a very, very low likelihood of anyone who might have been impacted by this actually having the logs and the data, because remember, it's just those heartbeats, to be able to go back and do any sort of attribution to them.
Yeah. Yeah, it's because it's so small. It's such a tiny thing to try and exploit.
Yeah. And then, who's looking for it, right? So who is, I understand we may have nation states doing mass packet captures of encrypted traffic in the hope that one day they'll be able to do something for it. But, you know, who is really doing that with heartbeats on mass? It's going to be a pretty small number.
Yeah, it seems unlikely. So, and that's another piece of this. Of course, anybody with any technical skill at all, you and me included, are being asked by all of our normal mortal friends, are we all going to die? Like, is it all over?
I've heard a few people liken it to the Y2K scenario. And, you know, I'm just old enough to have gone through that in a professional capacity. And, you know, for people that may not have, there was a lot of hysteria in the couple of years leading up to that. You know, is everything going to stop working on New Year's Eve? And, you know, the reality of it is a few things did, but it was nothing like what people thought it might be. And I have a sense that this is where we're heading now as well.
Well, and I worked on the Y2K bug and was a consultant in that time, and we fixed a lot of code. Mm. You know, the banking system had trial runs around it. Like in some ways, it was like we actually put out a heroic effort and pulled it off, which the cynical part of me is disappointed, because if we'd actually had a big incident, I wonder if it wouldn't have helped our industry be taken a little more seriously and be a little more controlled.
Yeah, but
the thing with the Y2K bug was you knew what the deadline was and there was some visibility into consequences. What's really evil about Heartbleed is you have no idea if you've actually had your key stolen or your password stolen. It's invisible to you as the victim.
Yeah, and this is the thing, that the lack of traceability is leading to a lot of speculation. So the sort of worst case scenario is we're saying, well, you know, that particular piece of code hit the air in something like March 2012, and it's really just over 2 years after that that it became public. So there's sort of these different windows of risk and conversely opportunity for attackers as well. So, you know, how many got on board with it early, maybe in 2012, and then how many of them got on board with it somewhere between about April 7 when it actually hit the public airwaves and however many days later that people patched it. I mean, we've seen things like people pulling credentials out of Yahoo. I mean, that is a serious organization to be able to pull data out of memory from.
Yeah, it's the thing is, if you have the vulnerability, you're basically able to grab 64K chunks of that server's memory, and all kinds of things go through that memory.
It does, and you know, honestly, it really didn't dawn on me. The impact of it didn't dawn on me until I actually ran this, and someone had a nice little .NET project I downloaded and ran against one of the sites that I'm responsible for. And I had to call people in. Hey, come and look at this. You won't believe this. You know, here it is, just dumping to a console window. That's my password. That's my username. That's these guys' session IDs. It's just unfathomably easy to exploit. That's what really, you know, got me when I saw it.
Yeah, it's staggering. Now, We're talking on April 18th. This whole thing's been going on for a couple of weeks now. It seems like certainly any credible site is now patched.
Well, you know, that's the interesting thing. So I guess it's a question of how we define credible. And I think it depends on how you look at it, because there's a lot of sites that aren't. So I saw a comment less than 24 hours ago from the head of CERT in Poland. And he said... In Poland, apparently there are over 9,500 IPs that were still vulnerable, and it was 15,700 something when it first hit, or same time last week. So what the guy is saying is, hey, more than half of our IPs are showing still vulnerable to Heartbleed. Now, I don't know how different Poland would be to other parts of the world. It's probably better than some and worse than others, but that's still a staggeringly large number of sites that are open.
That is in one relatively small country.
Yeah, exactly. And I guess the thing as well is that it's the risk is so easily enumerable. You know, if you've got a list of URLs, it is so fast to just send out that Heartbleed and seeing if it's going to echo any sort of malicious data back that it shouldn't be. We saw very early examples of people going through the Alexa top 10,000 and marking every single one of them as either vulnerable or not. So, wow. You know, that concerns me. And compounding that as well is that we're often seeing the presence of OpenSSL in response headers. So you can go to something like showdownhq.com, which actually searches for things like response headers in machines, and just go, hey, give me all the OpenSSL. Now, a bunch of that's going to be patched, but anecdotally, a bunch of it won't be as well.
Right. And then that's just known sites. You know, there's all kinds of dark stuff. People have forgotten they're running things. Like, there could be a lot of orphan sites out there that this is going to be exposed for some time. Are you running any tools in your browser just to keep an eye on what machines you're hitting and whether or not they're exposed?
So I haven't been running anything in the browser, but I do know that there's a couple of plugins. I know there's a Chrome plugin and a Firefox plugin where every site you visit, it will go and hit one of the services that was stood up very early to look for risk. So I guess that's kind of interesting. Probably going to be used for more nefarious purposes than what I should be partaking in. But for me, my process has been, look, I need to not just understand what is safe now, but I need to understand what might have been vulnerable before.
Right.
Because at some point, you have to make a judgment decision where you go, okay, was it vulnerable? And then how long was it vulnerable for? And then do some sort of risk assessment around what sort of data may have been exposed. And we're going to have to speculate because we don't have the logs. I mean, we're not logging heartbeats here, right?
Sure.
So we're going to have to sort of get all that together and then decide, okay, well, what are the appropriate actions to take as a result of that?
Well, I mean, the obvious one is everybody changing passwords on any machine, on any system they're using that's now patched. But do you feel like we need to throw out all our certs? I think it was your blog post that had the guys going, the cert services are going, oh, goody, 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 goody.
You know, the thing about the cert services, not only do they charge for new certs, certainly most of them do, a lot of them actually charge for revocations as well. So they're going, how good is this? You know, this is not just we're going to get SSL on a bunch of sites. We're actually going to charge them for revocation. But
yeah, we should be leaking major exploits to SSL every year. It's good for business.
Oh, well, there's a conspiracy theory. Who needs the NSA or the Russian mob if you've got the the certificate authority?
Well, and it's not like SSL certificate authorities have squeaky clean reputations these days.
Yeah, well, there's that. But look, I mean, cert revocation is one route. And in my mind, I think there are sort of different levels that you might apply depending on your degree of suspicion of a breach and also depending on the nature of the data. So, look, a really easy one is just expiring active sessions. So, you know, everyone's worried about passwords, but let's sort of think through the process. So someone comes to the website, they log in. There is one request that passes credentials. They then browse around, and every single time they hit a web page or they hit any other asset on the same domain, they're sending authentication cookies. So really, they're the ones that have the greatest exposure. Now, they've got the greatest exposure, but it's also the least impact to mitigate against that risk, because if you can expire those sessions, what's the worst that happens? Someone has to log in again. Okay, well, that's pretty low impact. So I'd be pretty comfortable doing that. When you step it up a notch, that's when you say, okay, well, it's also possible that their credentials may have been exposed. And then it's a question of, am I now telling consumers? So you're starting to sort of bring the consumer into the loop here, not just our techie folks. Am I telling these guys, you've now got to go and set a new password? And, you know, and then do I ask them nicely and make a suggestion that they do? Or do I force it?
Right. which I find kind of surprising.
Yeah.
Shouldn't Yahoo, the moment they finished patching their service, everybody who logged in, who had logged, and they could check to see had they logged in the window where that version of OpenSSL was being used, I need you to change your password.
Yeah. So look, I think the main thing there is it's just such a high friction sort of process.
Yes.
You're saying for Yahoo, you've got however many hundreds of millions of customers, and you're saying, okay, everybody's got to change passwords. Basically, you upset everybody to some degree. But of course, if you're emailing consumers, and I mean, I got one today from CrashPlan, and they said, okay, everybody, you really should change your password if you've logged onto the website. Now, that's actually sort of hitting every consumer and then making them aware of this thing that they've seen on the news that sounds scary, particularly because it's a bit hard to understand.
Yes.
So, that you know, that's sort of stepping it up. So we've got expiring sessions, easy, low impact. We've got password resets, which seems to be people just asking for it. And, of course, the next level, again, is the certificate revocation and issuing of new ones. And really what's happening here is we're saying we think the private keys of the certificate may have been disclosed. And there was a whole bunch of to and fro about whether this was possible. And in fact, the guy from Google who originally found this said, look, you know, we think it's actually really unlikely. Cloudflare went through and hammered away at it and said, oh, we think it's actually unlikely. We couldn't get it out. We'll stand up a little competition. We'll see if anyone can get our private keys. And of course, within hours, multiple parties had private keys.
Yeah.
So,
but isn't it interesting that this was done out in the public, essentially?
Well, I guess the whole thing became so public anyway, and there was so much public debate about is this possible or not. And this often happens in security, where someone's got a very academic thesis, if you like, about what someone might be able to do with a particular vulnerability. And it's normally not until it gets publicized and someone proves it that it kind of gets traction.
Yes. And the fastest way to do that is exactly what Cloudflare did.
Mm. Yeah, yeah. So look, I think in that regard, they've actually done us all a favor because they've put that debate behind us. And we haven't yet seen exactly how the guys who won the competition, if you like, actually did it. And they've sort of said, look, we'll give it another week and let people get a bit more patched and then we'll disclose it. But I have a strong suspicion that it's not just simply going to be the same vector that we've seen other people use to get things like session IDs and passwords. I think it's going to be a combination of that and something else. Otherwise, we would have seen this popped a lot earlier.
Yeah, when that still begs the question, you know, if there really was nefarious purposes behind there, somebody out there has already been using this for a while.
Yeah.
And nobody's been logging heartbeats.
Yeah, and that's the thing, and it leads to a lot of other speculation, because if we start talking about compromised private keys, the question then is, okay, well, what does that mean? What can we do with that? Well, it means that if anyone can get in the middle of the traffic now, then they can basically decrypt that traffic, and then they can either observe it or modify it or do any of those sort of things. So that's nasty, but you've still got to get a man in the middle of that. Now
you have to actually get in the location where you can see that encrypted stream.
Exactly, and of course that's one of the primary reasons why we have SSL to begin with. So there's you know, I don't want to devalue the importance of that. But when anyone in the world who can talk over port 443 can just pull data from your memory, you know, that to me is the bigger issue. But the other other tangent that becomes really interesting with private keys is that if any of that prior data was captured and stored, well, now private keys are going to unlock something that previously was a little bit useless. So if you are someone like the NSA and you're just hoovering up everything you can get your hands on the last few years, and you've got the ability to get in the middle of the traffic, and you've got the ability to store just huge volumes of data, you know, so a lot of stuff has got to line up. Well, yes, then if you also manage to get the private keys, which clearly is not an easy task, then you can exploit historical data.
Right. And that's really interesting if you've bothered to store that much data, because you had no idea what keys you were going to get. So you'll have to keep everything. But, you know, I'm not a conspiracy theory guy, Troy. Like, I'm pretty resilient to that. I'm not willing to attribute to malice that which can be explained by incompetence.
Yeah, and this is sort of the whole Occam's razor principle as well, isn't it? Often there are much more obvious explanations for what has gone on. So, you know, now we're seeing things like people jumping up and down saying, we've been hacked, hut leader. And you go, are you sure? You know, like, are you sure that it wasn't just someone had a bad password? And yeah. I am sure that there are cases where people are attributing to Heartbleed what is ultimately, as you say, attributable just to pure incompetence.
To a guy working late on New Year's Eve, you know, making a bad patch. And, you know, in some ways, I feel like the open source system let itself down, that was never looked at again. You know, we're supposed to have two pairs of eyes on everything.
Yeah, it's a tricky one. There's sort of this sort of whole sub-issue here around open source. And I think on the one hand, some people have an expectation that because it is open source and it's publicly inspectable, therefore we should have a higher degree of security and you know, right, less risk.
And one would argue that is true, yeah, because it did eventually get found.
Yeah, yeah. So, that, you know, that is true in that regard. And then the other thing is I don't think that ever implies 100% perfection in code. I mean, stuff gets found in whether it's open source or closed source. So I don't think it's fair for people to beat up on open source saying it sort of disproves the value proposition. And I also don't think it sort of supports those who say because it's open source, it's going to happen. Look, at the end of the day, it's people sitting down writing code, and we're fallible humans, right?
Yes. And I'm looking at what the OpenBSD guys are doing or saying they're going to do with OpenSSL, and it almost feels like they're overreacting. They're completely re-architecting this thing.
Yeah, so that's apparently what they're doing. Now, it's very hard to say because everybody's got different views into this and obviously has a different set of assets to protect. And if you're someone like OpenBSD, your reaction to it's probably going to be very different to if you're someone like, you know, Google or Yahoo. Look, I don't know that is necessarily the right thing to do to some degree throw the baby out. But yeah, those guys know their ecosystem better than anyone else, and there's a lot of smart people there, and they feel that's the right thing to do.
Well, and at the same time, you're also seeing pieces around the idea that OpenBSD needs more sponsorship, needs more funding and more contributions to really, you know, do the things that need to happen. So there's an interesting set of conflicts of interest here around what the right thing to do is.
That's also the whole argument around OpenSSL, right? That really something so ubiquitous that's probably on about 2/3 of the servers running websites on the net should have had some funding and greater overview for the betterment of everybody. And that's probably a pretty fair argument too.
And it's a very, it's an incredibly reasonable thing. If you're running OpenBSD stuff, and I am, you make a contribution. It's not that much money. And you just have non-trivial number of bytes of your stuff using it every day.
Yeah, yeah. No, that's very true.
And you sort of hinted at this, but we should probably dig into this, which is that OpenSSL running on web servers doesn't represent the bulk of the uses of OpenSSL.
Yeah.
You're in a lot of network appliances.
Well, you know, this is where I think it's going to get interesting. So my theory is I think we have about three phases to run with this. And the first is sort of the one that is the most prominent and immediately impactful, which is, hey, we've got web servers out there. You know, we've got Apache at about 52% of the net, and we've got Nginx at about 14% of the net, and it's running on those. So they're 2/3 of the net, and then a portion of those are running SSL. So that's that. And then, of course, there's the stuff that runs in front of the other things that don't run OpenSSL. So, you know, we've got a lot of IIS out there on the web. It's something that is particularly my interest. You look at something like Stack Overflow, they're all running on IIS, but the proxy sitting in front of it and is running on OpenSSL. So, you know, one of the things that I've been saying to people is don't just say, hey, I'm running IIS, or even worse, don't just say I'm running ASP.NET, because you could always run that on Nginx with someone like AppHarbor or something like that.
For sure.
The reach is actually much broader than that. So, you know, I think in this second phase, we're starting to go, hang on a second, we've got all these other components of the environment which are at risk as well. So But even things like web application firewalls, we're going to see a lot of those with OpenSSL issues. And then I think the third piece is now starting to get into these other devices. So there seems to be a slice of Android devices which are vulnerable. So that's one thing. But what I'm really interested in is what about all the devices with embedded software that are not updatable that talk over SSL? So I don't know, but I've got a set of those Withing scales. You know the ones you weigh yourself?
Yeah, yeah.
Do I have to patch my scales? Because I don't know how to patch my scales.
Because there's no simple way to tell either, other than to actually run heartbeat against your scale.
Well,
the other side of this is deciding how much risky data is there on my scale exactly.
Well, you know, this is the thing. So, I just don't know the answer, which is the tricky thing.
But I deeply appreciate the most important point here, especially for the audience at Run As Radio, which is, I know you're running IIS and you're running all Microsoft stack and you feel like, okay, well, this is not going to affect me, but do you know all your networking gear?
Yeah, that's...
Do you know what your ISP provided you?
That's it.
Do you know if that's running OpenSSL? Because in the end, it all impacts that.
That's it. The reality of it is that our ecosystems now around hosting infrastructure are generally a lot more than just one machine, right? We've got a lot of other dependencies. I mean, what even happens downstream of there? I mean, do you have backup services running on infrastructure that might be on OpenSSL? So, you know, is the website maybe not directly accessible, but other assets of it are? That's something we're yet to see play out. And so many things now have an IP address.
In some ways, I'm almost glad this happened now, because 5 years from now, you know, when the Internet of Things is much further along, because I feel like we're still in early days, these kinds of exploits are going to be more and more serious. I mean, and I don't want to indict open source, but could we indict SSL? Is it time for a better secure protocol?
Well, I think it's sort of the best mousetrap we've got at the moment. And of course, there are flavors of SSL. So things like perfect forward secrecy would have actually mitigated the risk of keys, at least, getting out there. So there are ways that we can do it better than some of the other ways. But I think that at the moment, in terms of securing the transport layer, so I think there are different flavors of SSL. And I kind of hope that out of this, we don't sort of get a jaded perception of SSL, because at the end of the day, that really is a pretty critical component. We're just sending more and more and more stuff over HTTP that we need to protect, and that's our best model at the moment.
Yes. And again, you know, there's one group of people that say we should use HTTP for everything, which we seem to be doing, and some saying we are abusing this protocol. We should spread out our protocols again.
So I think the worst case scenario, I saw someone, it was a local football club here in Australia, who seemed to be rather proud of the fact that they didn't have an open SSL vulnerability because everyone was logging in over HTTP anyway. you're right, but oh man, guys, come on.
Well, and you bring up an interesting point, which is it actually depends on your authentication strategy. Correct me if I'm wrong, but if I was actually using Windows Digest Authentication, I'm not sending a password anyway. It's in a hash. So you may be able to sniff my hash out of the Heartbleed vulnerability, but you're not getting my password.
So it's a question of what you can replay, because the same could be said about using an OpenID provider as well. So, you know, if we're logging on with Facebook, then, okay, we have a risk in terms of if Facebook was vulnerable. But after that, we get a token. And if my website is vulnerable, okay, someone can mount a replay attack by getting that token and then effectively hijacking the session, but they can't actually get the credentials because that's gone off to Facebook.
Right. Yeah, interesting point. You can hijack the session, but you can't generate your own session.
But of course, look at that the other way, right? So how many people authenticate through Yahoo to multiple services?
Yes.
And then we know that Yahoo was vulnerable. And there are screen grabs of, you know, memory dumps from Yahoo out there. So turning it around, it's like, hey, this is the keys to the castle that could actually make things really bad as well.
Yeah. I don't know. I still feel like if I was running a website that had been exploited, I would want all new keys just in case. Like I don't know that the amount of time it'll take to sort of figure out what's been exposed is worthwhile compared to the remedy, which is replace the keys and change the passwords.
Yeah, correct. And look, we are seeing a lot of sites that have new certificates already. So every time I get one of these emails that says you really should go and change your password, and it's a consumer-facing email, I jump over to the website and have a look at when the certificate was issued. So I had a right. look at Crash Plan yesterday, and Crash Plan was issued on something like the 10th of April. So yeah, clearly right. these guys very early on said, right, that's it. Just get rid of the old one. Jump on something new. We don't know. I assume they wouldn't have known if they had actually been exploited or not. But at the end of the day, it's a new certificate. You know, it's not rocket yes. science.
Yeah. It's a few hundred dollars. It's just not that much. And, you know, there is the politics of security here. The same way they're not insisting you change your password, they're just suggesting it. So they're saying, we're taking responsibility for a potential exploit. We're admitting that we could have been there and giving you our best recommendation. If you choose not to do it, you know, we've sort of done our duty.
Yeah. And do you get the sense that people are maybe trying to, or organizations are trying to indemnify themselves a little by saying that?
Yeah. Yeah, we, the same way they said, you know, objects are in the mirror may be closer than they appear, and don't feed the lions, right? It's just, you know, we told you.
Yeah, yeah. And then it's sort of like, well, you know, you've only got yourself to blame now. But yeah, of course, the reality of it is that stuff could have been stolen totally beyond your control, regardless of what your yeah. password state was.
Yes, absolutely true. So, Troy, getting into the end of our half hour here, is there places you're pointing people who are thinking, okay, well, I didn't think this was affecting me. Now I think it is. How do I find out?
Yeah, look, I mean, obviously, to be a little bit self-indulgent, on troyhunt.com, there's a big piece there on Heartbleed. So that one has well and truly done the rounds. And I've tried to sort of answer this from the perspective of the various roles. So if right. you're a sysadmin, what do I do? If I'm a developer, what do I do? If I run a service, what do I do? So I think that's a pretty good starting point. There's been a lot of other stuff that's gone through the news since this hit, but really none of the guidance has changed. And it's the stuff we've discussed today, you know, expiring sessions, yep. maybe asking for password changes, new certs if you're worried, that sort of stuff. And honestly, that's pretty much what it boils down to. And most of the rest mm-hmm. of the noise around this is speculation about conspiracy theories or whether disclosure was done right or who knew what when. But the core yeah. risk really hasn't changed in the last couple of weeks.
Yeah, and that's all after the fact stuff. It's what, you know, what do you need to do today? Change your password. Well, fix the hole, change your certs, change the passwords, preferably in that order.
Yep, yeah, exactly.
Troy, thanks so much for talking to me.
Thanks very much, Richard.
And we'll talk to you next week on Run As Radio.